First, I would like to introduce the SRP team at Columbia University. We will hear from Dr. Ana Navas-Acien, a physician and epidemiologist at Columbia University and the director of the Columbia University SRP Center. We will also hear from the SRP project leaders, Dr. Alexander Van Heen, a senior research scientist, and Dr. Benjamin Bostick, an associate research professor, both at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. More information about each presenter is available on the CLUIN seminar page. So Columbia team, thank you for being here, and I will turn it over to you.
Thank you. Can you hear us?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity to present today, and good afternoon to everybody who is listening online. I am Ana Navas-Acien. I am the recent new director of the Superfund Research Program at Columbia University following the steps of Dr. Joseph Graziano. And I am delighted to be here with Alexander Van Geen and Benjamin Bostick. And what we want to share with you the work that we are doing as part of our Superfund Research Program to do work on the health effects and geochemistry of arsenic. Our program has, you can see in the slide, has four projects, two health sciences projects, and two earth science and engineering projects. And it serves by a number of cores to do the science and also to make sure our science has an impact and is translated appropriately and is able to reach the communities that are affected by the problem of arsenic in groundwater and other environmental sources. And I am going to start presenting the health science projects, in particular our project one, that is an observational study, and also briefly project two, that is an interventional trial to mitigate the health effects of arsenic. So let's start with project one. And our project one is titled The Health Effects of Arsenic Longitudinal Study. This is a prospective cohort study that has been going on in Al-Azhar, Bangladesh, since 2001. And in this figure, you can see the large variability in arsenic exposure that was affecting this community in Bangladesh, with the well, that is, each of these dots represents a primary well, with the and the levels of the arsenic in the well. And you can see that there is tremendous heterogeneity, with some wells having very low levels of arsenic, below 10 micrograms per liter, and some wells having levels above 50 and even above 100, with more than 50% of the participants being exposed to more than 50 micrograms per liter, and around a quarter of the participants being exposed to less than 10. These data are extremely valuable from an epidemiological perspective and provide the opportunity to understand which are the long-term health consequences of drinking arsenic level at those levels, and to compare the populations who are otherwise very similarly in those communities. So we have here one study published a number of years ago, and first of all, we have the in the top part of the slide, we have the cohort that was reached almost 12,000 participants enrolled at the baseline when the Columbia University Superfund Research Program started in 2002. And through the follow-up, we are now at follow-up 6, we have been able to collect additional information, and this information has enabled us, especially by looking at the health outcomes, to understand what are the health consequences of long-term arsenic exposure. In one of the manuscripts that we are sharing with you today, published in the British Medical Journal, we investigated and found that arsenic exposure is related to increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And these tables show the hazard ratios across quartiles of water arsenic and urinary arsenic, as well as per standard deviation in water arsenic and urinary arsenic. And you can see that there is a clear dose-response relationship, although there is some limited statistical significance at the low-level arsenic exposure. But overall, these findings support that arsenic is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. As part of our current Superfund research program activities in the current cycle, We are also combining the data from Bangladesh with studies from other populations worldwide, doing a full analysis and a dose risk and looked at the dose response meta-analysis. The findings of this paper were published just recently, less than a year ago. And in this pooled meta-analysis, you can see that populations across different parts of the world, a limited number of studies for incidence cardiovascular disease and mortality cardiovascular disease, there is very consistent finding across different populations with an increased risk for cardiovascular disease. In the bottom figure, we have the findings of the dose response meta-analysis showing that, again, there's an increased risk. However, one of the limitations of the current evidence is what is the dose response relationship at low, moderate levels of exposure. And if you look at coronary heart disease mortality, if you look at the coronary heart disease mortality below 10 micrograms per liter, for mortality, there is a suggestion of a linear increased risk, indicating that there might be no threshold. However, if you look at this below 10 for coronary heart disease incidence, depending on which model fit we set up, a log linear model versus a non-linear model, allowing for a flexible dose response relationship, there is some suggestion that there could be a threshold and that there could be a flat lack of excess risk at the lower levels, and then the risk increases. Unfortunately, the number of studies available at the low level is still too limited for us to have firm conclusions regarding the dose-response relationship, and more research is needed. We are now going to show you what the most recent findings in the HILLS cohort, and I want for a second to go back to this figure that represents the baseline exposure levels that were happening in 2000-2001. And I want you to breathe for a second and look at what's happening today as of 2017-2018. And you can see how the picture has dramatically changed. From less than a quarter of participants being exposed to less than 10 at baseline, we now have more than half of the participants actually being exposed to less than 10 micrograms per liter. And only less than a quarter being exposed to more than 50 micrograms per liter. These are very important, dramatic, recent changes in exposure that require this additional research to understand what is the impact of changing exposure levels to arsenic. I am going to also provide a very brief update about Project 2 that is directed by Dr. Mary Gamble. And this project is a clinical trial looking at additional possible interventions to mitigate the health effects of arsenic when exposure cannot be easily changed. And her research has shown that B vitamins, in particular folate, but also B12, can increase the excretion of the methylation of arsenic and the excretion of arsenic. This trial is looking at children and has currently enrolled 146 children, and more than 100 have completed the intervention. Now I am going to give the speaker to Ben Bosick, who is going to explain about
Project 3. So Project 3 is dedicated to the practical goal of remediating arsenic contamination at Superfund sites. About half of all Superfund sites, a little bit more than half, have arsenic as a contaminant of concern. Most of those Superfund sites, there's been a broad range of remediation technologies that have attempted to address contamination in general. Some of those contaminants are successfully remediated from those, but arsenic has proven to be one of the really difficult ones to deal with in most remediation. Our approach at doing that is to try something a little bit differently than has been done, and that is to create in the ground iron oxides primarily that are especially good at retaining arsenic and thereby effective at removing arsenic from the solution and transferring it to the solid where it's relatively stable. This is a recent paper, I think it came out 2 months ago or so, where we have investigated the model using sediments from the Dover Superfund site in New Hampshire to identify the pathways that are most effective in creating magnetite in solution from solutions of groundwater and looking at how that affects arsenic retention in the phase. So if we look at the So if we look here at the mechanism, what happens is we introduce iron and nitrate into water, and that iron and nitrate in water through microbial processes is converted to different forms of iron minerals in the solid phase. It takes a really small quantity of the iron minerals in the solid phase to retain arsenic at enough for it to affect the amount of arsenic in solution. So the graphs here on the right show how in the top case, arsenic, the important part is so that when we add the iron and nitrate into the solution, what happens is the arsenic concentrations quickly go down and they stay down for a long time, even as water is flowing through that sediment. And it's shown, we think it's a potentially a very viable remediation option for actually applications at Superfund sites as a remediation technology. To do that, we're investigating in the field how we can actually apply these technologies. All those sort of mechanistic experiments happen in the lab, and translating them to the field is our big goal. And we're currently trying to do that in two different locations. As part of this project, the Superfund project, we're working primarily at the Lot 86 Superfund site at North Carolina State University, next to the football stadium, for any of you who might know where that is. At another field site that has quite extensive arsenic contamination naturally in China, in the Yinchuan Plain, we're looking at doing groundwater injections in those sites where to look at, in the case of North Carolina State, a way of preventing off-site transport of arsenic, and in Yinchuan as a way of looking at how potentially it could be used both in wells that are drinking water wells, but also just in general, how we can constrain the mechanisms of formation. So here's our first field injection showing how this actually works. There's a little picture. In this case, it's a field trial. It's an exciting result. We're sort of still figuring out how things are going and trying to perfect it. This represents an injection of about 1 cubic meter. So to give you an idea, a cubic meter of water is not a huge amount. It's 1,000, you know, still, it's a fair amount of volume. But it's a reasonably modest volume to inject into the ground. And what we do is we're injecting into a well. It's so hard to find this little cursor. We inject into the well here, and then that water around that cubic meter of water is replacing the natural groundwater in here. And then reacting chemically to create magnetite. And now, based on our data that we've obtained from laboratory simulations, we can see that we expect magnetite to precipitate this new mineral form for within about a meter, in this case, of the wellhead, so that you're just putting a little bit of mineral out there. And in fact, it's about 1/1000th of the volume of the sediments that are already there. So it's a very small quantity that's required. And in doing so, their natural groundwater decreases from about 500 micrograms per liter initially down quickly to a couple of micrograms per liter. And it's actually maintained as we're continuing to pump on this water or pump on this well. In this case, we pumped about 100 or 150 meters cubed of water out of the well before we saw arsenic start to come out of the well. So again, there's a couple things that are really significant here to point out. One is it remediated arsenic. It did so with only a small volume of injectant, and the data that we learned and mechanistically from the model that was used to generate this plot here at the upper right is actually able to simulate the measured concentrations reasonably well with some complexities and other things going on. But it's really helps us to think about how we can scale our model from laboratory studies up into the field scale, and is our really first, our first successful attempt to do so. As we go towards North Carolina and thinking about it, one of the first things we need to know is how water flows through the system. So this is one of the things that we're working on is developing the hydrologic model that then we can use to plan an injection that would then be most effective at treating arsenic as the water's flowing through the system under normal gradient. So with that, I'll transfer to Lex here.
Thanks, Ben. Good afternoon. I'm going to take you for Project 4. I'm going to take you back to some maps in Bangladesh. And in the context of the very practical obligation that we feel, which is to try to help reduce exposure to the extent we can. But at the same time, you'll see that some of the mechanistic insights that we've obtained from this work on a rather large scale links it back to Superfund sites in the U.S. And landfills in particular. So these three maps are based on a blanket testing of about 50,000 wells conducted in 2012-13, so a little more than midway through the project. And the map divides the wells according to the depth, their depth. The color scale is the same as you saw in Anna's previous slides. So blue means up to 10 microgram per liter, green is between 10 and 50, and red and brown is above that. So, the first thing that you get from this is that most of the wells are shallow, and they were privately installed in the 10 to 45 meter range. And you can see that there you have both high and low arsenic, and as Anna pointed out, a highly spatially heterogeneous distribution of arsenic. What has happened since we started the work in 2000 is the installation of a large number of intermediate wells in some parts of the largest sort of administrative unit that includes the HEALS study area. I need to do it again. All right. Yes. So this is the map that Anna showed you. That's where the cohort study is taking place, and we've just taken a step back to include this area that includes a population of about 380,000 drinking from 50,000 wells. And I'll show you some time series in a second. So you can see that this intermediate aquifer between 45 and 90 meters, this is depth where the installation of wells is logistically and financially still affordable by individual households. And you can see that those households who are drinking from these intermediate wells, by and large, they have reduced their exposure considerably. Not everywhere, and we'll get to that, but certainly by and large. And then you have another category of wells. These are the wells that require a bigger rig that's typically brought in from the outside. They're more expensive. They cost about $800. And these are largely installed by the government, essentially, or NGOs active in the area. And you can see that there are very few wells that are high in arsenic in that depth range. But the problem is that these deep wells are not accessible by essentially a majority of the exposed population. So let's go to the next slide to see at when these wells have been installed. So if you focus on the three panels to the left first, the x-axis is time. And remember that the cohort study started in 2000, so a little bit to the left of the middle of this picture. And all this shows essentially is of the 50,000 wells that were tested, we tested them with a field kit, I should point out. We also asked the households, when did you install your well? And what is the depth of the well? People know the depth of their well typically because they paid for every section of PVC pipe that went into their installation and were often present. So we think that this is a pretty robust data set. So the upper panel of this, of the three of the vertical sort of lineup of figures, are the shallow wells, and you can see that we're getting into as recently, and this is in 2-year bins, I should point out. So in the most recent 2-year bins, 5,000 shallow wells were installed that were high in arsenic, A sizable number, about 3,000, were installed that were very low in arsenic, and then we have this thinner sliver in between of about, you know, 800 wells that are green, so between 10 and 50 micrograms per liter. And what you can see is that this number has continued to grow. So there were on the order of 30,000 wells in 2000 in this area, and that number has grown. So people continue to install wells. The initial average of number of users per well was on the order of 11, and now it's about half of that. The biggest surprise from the ongoing follow-up, follow-up 6 that Anna referred to, is this installation of intermediate wells. So this is the blue line here starting that has been going on essentially since the testing we conducted, but also the government has conducted a blanket survey in 2003. And this is really what has lowered the exposure of a majority of the population. Sure, the deep wells, they are a larger proportion of those is low in arsenic as well, but you can see that, you know, about 300 of those were installed, and I can tell you that for various reasons, including a leaked capture, essentially, of this public good, these are not used by the majority of the population. So we are very interested in this intermediate depth range. We know that not all of them are low in arsenic. And in fact, we have one monitoring, a nest of monitoring wells we installed within this area. And you can see that, you know, the shallow wells, or there's a 29-meter well here, that one has stayed very high at about 250 micrograms per liter at one extreme. We have a deep well of 91 meters. That one has, you know, stayed well below 5 micrograms per liter throughout the period. Then we have a green one in between. The worrisome part is that we have this well at 41 meters, shown in red here, which met the Bangladesh standard of 50 micrograms per liter, which used to be the EPA standard about until about 2001, that has steadily been increasing in arsenic. And so we are concerned about that. We have some ideas on why this might be happening. One thing is that Dhaka, the municipal water supply of Dhaka, about 20 kilometers to the west, is drawing a lot of water, and so there is a vertical head gradient that tends to draw water from the shallow aquifer into greater depth. And, you know, before you reach the deep aquifer, you will reach this intermediate aquifer. So that's one source of concern. Before, you know, advocating much more installation of intermediate wells, you want to know whether that's a good advice to give. So what is happening in terms of mechanism? Is what we think is the following. The two sort of photographs in this slide are a fairly standard representation of what's happening below ground. It shows orange sands, typically covered by iron three oxides, being reduced, turning gray, essentially. So the rust is being dissolved and reduced. And the reaction here, what's typically evoked is essentially dissolved or sedimentary organic carbon. So that is the source of electrons to reduce the iron. And the standard picture is that this is sedimentary organic carbon, organic acid of various types. What we are finding in our detailed process studies in the intermediate aquifer is that we're finding a remarkable correlation in aquifers that we know used to be orange because we've tasted the material, and the layers that have turned gray, and so that's probably related to the increase in arsenic in a small fraction of the wells, they happen to be very high in methane as well. And so we are now exploring this alternative mechanism, which is that the methane is the main source of, is the main reductant that is leading to the reduction of the iron oxides and therefore the arsenic release. And this matters because dissolved organic carbon probably is retarded by absorptions to sediments relative to groundwater flow. Methane doesn't stick to material, and so it could be transported more quickly. This brings us to the U.S. relevance. If there's one thing landfills do, it is exporting methane in very large amounts. And it has been documented by a number of studies, including some involving Superfund, that downstream of landfills, you will often find elevated levels of arsenic. And what we want to explore now is to what extent this could be due less because of the export of dissolved organic carbon, but perhaps more so by more rapid supply of methane. And I'll leave it at that.
Yes, and just one quick minute to finish our presentation. discussing our community engagement and translation, research translation activities. We have been very engaged in Maine, supporting legislation and following several attempts. Finally, last summer, a year ago, the legislation was approved in Maine to ensure safe drinking water for families and testing, require arsenic testing. We also have a series of targeted testing activities going on with healthcare providers in New Jersey. And you have, there are some pictures showing our FedEx kits helping that are offered to the patients in the clinic, and they can then test their water. Many other activities are ongoing with the physicians and the medical staff in these clinics. And also you can see our billboard that was shown to encourage arsenic testing and intervention for families affected by using private wells for drinking water. And finally, I want to share this last paper that we have. We published less than a year ago, showing the impact, evaluating the impact of the Environmental Protection Agency change in legislation regarding the maximum contaminant level for arsenic. And in this figure, using data from NHANES, you can check how looking at trends of urinary arsenic over the time for community, for public water users, there was a 17% reduction. There has been a 17% reduction in arsenic in the urine across overall the overall United States. However, if you look at private wells, we see no change, basically no change in exposure. These findings confirmed that, first of all, public interventions, public water systems can be improved and can have a major impact in reducing exposures, but they also show us that private wells currently are unprotected, and there is urgent need to do interventions to protect the private well users. And with that, we want to finish our presentation of the Columbia Superfund Research Program. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Great. Thank you so much for a fantastic presentation. Just a reminder to everyone, you may submit questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner. So the first question that came through is, in slide 5 versus slide 6 showing the arsenic levels, why was there a change in arsenic levels?
This is related to the changes in exposure levels in Bangladesh. And I think Dr. Van Gien can actually explain more about that, but I understand it's because of the installation of this middle depth well. Is that right?
That's right, Anna. So one thing, you know, so HEALS is only covering a portion of that administrative unit. What happened in 2003 is that all the wells were tested by the government and an NGO for arsenic, and the spouts of the wells were painted red when the arsenic was too high. And so what we're looking there essentially is an enormous experiment, an intervention, and the first response, and we've documented that, is that 60% of the people who were initially drinking the high arsenic water in the HEALS area switched to a neighboring well. You know, that's the advantage of the spatial heterogeneity. And then all the time, their next move has been, we're going to reinstall our well to an intermediate aquifer that we know from our driller, and maybe we played a role in conveying that information as well, where we reach the orange sands, and therefore the arsenic will be low. So, and sure, the government's wells help to some extent. There was even a pipe water supply system more recently installed. But the effect of these sort of rather infrastructure-heavy investments are essentially dwarfed by private initiative to lower exposure.
Great, thank you. The next question that came through was, in the Indian subcontinent, open, fairly shallow wells are installed as a source of drinking potable water. Are the shallow wells on this slide similar to those open wells?
So I think this question is referring to dug wells. which yes. have a wider diameter, and is sort of the traditional well we have in mind, of course. So these are somewhat shallower. You know, they just need to go below the water table. And the government, I think correctly, has been discouraging a big expansion of those, because typically you will have microbial contaminations, microbial pathogens in these open wells, even if you cover them. So dug wells were for a while touted as a solution, but I think most people involved in the field now don't see them as a long-term solution because of this enormous population density and generally poor sanitation.
Thank you. Another question that came through is, the recommended remediation was very exciting for the shallow well. Would you please expand on this discussion?
So, yeah, I'm happy to. The remediation is, there's a couple things that are really important. We're most significant is arsenic is usually high in water under conditions where iron oxides are unstable. Basically, it's sort of like if you think of arsenic sticking to a carpet, the typical reducing aquifer that's undergoing chemical reduction from these organic molecules and turning gray that like Lex was talking about sort of pulls the carpet out and the arsenic goes into solution. And it doesn't ever it's being continuously pulled out and sort of stays in solution. What we're doing is trying to engineer the production of minerals that don't dissolve under those conditions, so they stay there. And when they stay there, and the arsenic sticks to iron really well, typically that's how you treat water in a sewage treatment plant or things like that, or a water treatment plant in general. So that if you have these materials present and arsenic flows through the system, the arsenic will stick to it really well. And for us to make the iron oxides that are stable is really where the scientific innovation comes from, and that we're going through a microbial process that actually involves nitrate and the biological reduction of nitrate to nitrite, and that's both chemical and biological production of the iron oxides from those intermediates. A big portion of our lab work has been to fine-tune the chemistry and understand that biological role of the reaction so that we can enhance this process in the field by adjusting the solutions that we would inject into the ground and so forth. So that's kind of where our lab work and field work meet, and then the field work field experiments are very complicated, so you can only do so many things. You can't try every injection. So what we want to do is make sure we get the one that's going to work when we go out and try it in the field. Hopefully that's enough of a start anyway.
All right, thank you. And I actually have a question for you guys. For Project 3, is the remediation technique something that's easily deployable in like a low resource setting? Is that what you guys are going for? Or is this going to be a much larger scale where it'll take a lot more time to set up something like this?
So, ideally it's a relatively scalable thing. And the injection solution is reasonably simple under at least ideal conditions. And it's certainly as simple as enough. As a professor, you're telling my grad students something simple is never a good idea. but generally, you know, it is a reasonably low-tech approach. And it doesn't involve injecting a solid and figuring out how to distribute it through the matrix. It doesn't involve a lot of digging. It's passive in the sense that you're just injecting a solution. And depending on what's already there, the microbes that are there are able to do it relatively easily. And so, in that sense, actually, I think it's relatively cheap and effective. A year ago or so, we at the ACS meeting, there was a session that the NIEHS coordinated where we estimated the cost of this remediation technology to be at least 100 times lower than the pump and treat options, which essentially go forever. So we do think it's a reasonably cheap and hopefully accessible method of working on it, and we actually are starting to have a large number of people that are expressing interest in thinking about how to do that. So it's kind of exciting to start seeing the technology turn a corner.
Great, thank you for that answer. Let's see, the next question that came in is, how do you optimize magnetite surface area to adsorb arsenic?
It turns out you don't really have to optimize the surface area. You have to get magnetite to form. That happens over through an active iron cycle, but the surface area of a mineral that's precipitating is determined by the supersaturation extent. So it's kind of a technical answer, but the answer is magnetite is brutally insoluble. So if you, a typical solution is 15 or orders of magnitude supersaturated. So under very supersaturated conditions, particles are always small. That's why soil particles are clayey. Is that the iron oxides are all insoluble and form very, very small particles. So in general, it's hard to get magnetite crystals that are large. And in fact, I don't remember which slide number it is, but this first slide in my section actually shows that we're forming magnetites that are between 6 and 10 nanometers, which is pretty commonly seen because that's where the supersaturation extent sort of is high enough that you get rapid precipitation. So that's almost always the size it is, regardless of how we do it.
Okay, another question came through. How do you know you're making large deposits or not?
Large deposits of magnetite? Well, we know how much we inject, and we can, in the lab experiments, we use spectroscopy to measure how much of everything gets formed. Magnetite's also kind of nice in that it's magnetic, so you have an additional way of testing. So we have some idea of yield. We also have the amount of nitrate that's added, which presumably puts an upper ceiling on the amount of things. So there's a lot of like stoichiometric controls on that. In terms of where it's produced and how distributed, that's one of the reasons why the quantitative modeling is so important, because if you generate magnetite over a bigger volume, it changes how the effect on concentration in the well when you measure it and things. So the models actually do a lot to tell us about the distribution of magnetite, because that's essentially, and the rate of precipitation determines how fast. In this case, it precipitates reasonably slowly, so you actually get magnetite dispersed through a fairly large volume, even with a bigger volume actually than the injection volume. So we have a kind of an advantage there from the slow kinetics that help us to distribute magnetite over a big area. But luckily, we don't have to detect it everywhere. In situ in the underground, it's hard to do.
Okay, and then another question came in. Nitrite is a health concern, too, as a result of arsenic control. How do you balance that?
So certainly the answer is, yeah, nitrate injection, nitrate is a health concern. It's a health concern usually at a higher threshold than arsenic, so nitrates aren't the things that matter at the part per billion level. That said, it's still something to think about. In our case, the only places that we're really thinking of using this kind of a technology are the reducing groundwaters where arsenic is common. The lifetime of nitrate in those environments is very, very low. So, in fact, the nitrate in these experiments stoichiometrically disappears. It turns into nitrogen gas through denitrification. In fact, we depend on those denitrifying reactions as our to create the iron oxides that we need to form.
Okay,
so
great.
It's gone.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
It's gone within a few days, literally.
Okay. Thank you again to the Columbia team for presenting, for a great presentation. If there's any more questions, please add them to the Q&A pod, and we can ask them if there's time at the end, or we can send them along to the presenters today. And so now we will hear from the team at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology SRP Center. Dr. Bevan Engelward, a professor of biological engineering at MIT, directs the MIT SRP Center. We will also hear from the SRP project leader, Dr. Tim Swager, and John MacArthur. The John MacArthur professor in the MIT Department of Chemistry. So more information about each presenter is available on the CLUIN seminar homepage, so please check that out if you want any more information. And MIT team, thank you for being here and presenting, and I will turn it over to you guys.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Thank you, everybody. This is really a nice opportunity to tell you about our Superfund program. And please keep in mind, we're brand new. We've been in business for about a year. So my goal is to give you an overview of what our program's about and then Tim Swager will follow by talking to you about one of the projects. So the program is run by me and John Essigman, and of course we represent a team. We have a great team with a lot of diverse backgrounds ranging from biological engineering to civil and environmental engineering and Department of Earth and Atmospheric Planetary Sciences. So it's a diverse group, and together we really have a pretty unified program, which I'll explain. Of course, everything is made possible by the trainees. We have a super group of trainees, again, with diverse backgrounds and a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of collaboration happening. So my talk is going to be in four parts. And the first I'm going to talk about the contaminants of interest, and then I'll tell you an overview of the projects. I'll tell you just a little bit about our engagement and translation activities, and then turn it over to Tim. So we're focused on the Mystic River watershed. That's the green area where water flows down to the Boston Harbor. And there are several Superfund sites in that area, and in particular, we're interested in the Olin Chemical Superfund site. So in the Mystic River watershed, there's been a lot of industrial activities. There's more than 21 different companies have been here, including tanneries, rubber, textiles, paper, et cetera, leading to a lot of contamination. And at Olin, from 1953 to 1970, waste have been discharged into lagoons and ponds that are right next to the Olin Chemical Company. So although there's a lot of different contaminants present, the one that people are most concerned about is NDMA, or N-nitrosodimethylamine. So the interest in this and the concern is has been for quite some time. And in a local newspaper, it was written, quote, they've discovered ammonia, chloride, sodium, and sulfate at the site, but the most important and the most toxic is NDMA. And this remains a really serious concern. A resident from Wilmington recently said, quote, I managed to survive childhood cancer, but several others like me in Wilmington who were affected were not so fortunate. And people are wondering if they're still at risk and how NDMA might be moving around in the environment and whether that will affect their risk going forward. I just want to point out that the Mystic River watershed is also home to the Malden and Everett communities, which are environmental justice communities. So part of our efforts for engagement and education are focused on these communities. So since our program is really based on NDMA contamination, I'm going to tell you just a little bit about the chemistry so that you can understand the biology and what's the underlying driver of most of our program, or a lot of our program. So NDMA reacts with DNA, and that can lead to cancer. And so NDMA can be processed by P450 metabolism, by P452E1, to break down to form methyl diazonium ion, which is highly unstable. And what can happen is the methyl group can be added to DNA. So here you can see a normal guanine reacting with methyl diazonium ion. And what happens is you get a methyl group on the guanine to form O6-methylguanine. So what's actually quite remarkable is that that very small change, just one methyl group, can have a very significant biological effect. The reason is, or at least one of the reasons is, because it promotes mutations. So here's a normal GC base pair. And when we look at O6-methylguanine, what we can see is that this damaged base pairs very well with thymine. And so the end result is that during replication, the wrong base can be put in opposite, and you end up with GC to AT mutations. And we know that mutations are what drive cancer. And so it's consistent that DNA damage basically changes the structure of DNA. That leads to mutations, and in turn, those mutations drive cancer. Fortunately, we have DNA repair. In the case of O6-methylguanine, the key DNA repair enzyme is O6-methylguanine methyltransferase, which can recognize the damage on the DNA and remove it. For those of you who are in the life sciences, a little higher resolution picture here. As you can see, the protein flips the nucleotide right outside of the helix into an active site where it performs chemistry. And it's kind of interesting protein because what it does is it reacts with, it has a cysteine that reacts with the methyl group, and the cysteine actually transfers the methyl group from the DNA to itself to restore guanine. And what this means is that biologically we have an entire protein whose only purpose is to repair one single methyl group, which gives you a sense of how important evolutionarily it is to repair this kind of damage. So Our program is focused on, some, of course, biological endpoints as well as engineering endpoints, and it's just one piece of the program is focused on this methyltransferase. And so we have DNA repair knockout mice, and one of them is for the methyltransferase. And so this enables us to look specifically at the biological consequences of one specific lesion, the 06-methylguanine. And so endpoints that we're looking at include cancer, mutation spectra, gene-environment interactions, system-level responses, and then on the engineering side, sensing and spatiotemporal dynamics in the environment. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you a little bit about our other focus, which is on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And what we're particularly concerned about is the Mi'kmaq tribe, which is in northern Maine, and they are focused on conserving their traditional culture. And one of their challenges is that they have inherited a Superfund site. So the Mi'kmaq tribe acquired the Loring Air Force Base Superfund site, which is, you know, the idea was this would be really good for them. They'd get some land, and this would be helpful. But, of course, the Mi'kmaq lands are contaminated with industrial chemicals, including known carcinogens. And despite quite a lot of effort that's gone into cleanup, the fish are still unsafe to eat, and they're still concerned that berries and roots and other traditionally relevant natural products could be affected by these contaminating chemicals. Importantly, the Mi'kmaqs have been told by the PRP, which is the Air Force, that they cannot safely use parts of their land for homes and natural resources. So they really cannot use the land the way it was intended. And our team is basically focused on preventing exposure to carcinogens and hopefully providing information that will help both with prevention of exposure and possible additional mitigation. So the Loring Air Force Base has been contaminated by a lot of different things. Of course, you can imagine an Air Force Base has fuel contamination, solvents, there's a lot of coal usage, and then firefighting foams. So there's really quite a lot of different kinds of contamination problems on this one particular piece of property. One that is of concern is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which is what we're focusing on. And I just want to point out that about 1,200 people get their drinking water from wells that are within 3 miles of this base. And since there's a plume, there's some concerns about the plume actually affecting the drinking water. So prior to development of the MIT Superfund, the Center for Environmental Health Sciences here at MIT, which is led by John Essigman, has been engaged with the Mi'kmaq tribe. MIT has a longstanding relationship. Our team has been interacting with the Mi'kmaqs for over 6 years. And this effort was really led by John Essigman and Kathy Vandiver with support from others, including Drs. Croy and Celine. And so this just shows a picture of the MIT team members working with the director of the Mi'kmaq Environment Lab. There have been a number of activities that happened thanks to this Center for Environmental Health Sciences interactions, and this includes Professor Noel Celine giving a talk about mercury contamination in fish. There have been cultural events that the MIT team has been invited to. This is a picture of Kathy Vandiver working with Marvin Kling, one of the Passamaquoddy members, and she has some really exciting educational tools that are now being provided to the Mi'kmaq tribe. So in terms of research through engagement, we've learned a lot about the concerns of the Mi'kmaq. We were just up there last month. And we've also learned a lot from the Air Force, who's been the primary responsible party for cleaning up the Superfund site. Our goal now is, of course, to address the concerns of the Mi'kmaq tribe in terms of which contaminants they're most concerned about and ways that we can be helpful. And, of course, our research is aimed at learning more about contamination and using what we learn to guide decision-making on safe ways to use the land, as well as possible additional cleanup efforts. We're also, of course, involved in engagement and education. We aim to help bridge the Mi'kmaqs with stakeholders who can be helpful. We aim to provide technical support, interpretation of scientific and technical documents. And we also aim to continue to provide educational support. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears and give you an overview of the project. So our center has 5 projects and 4 cores. The projects, we have 2 environmental science and engineering projects and 3 biomedical projects. Our topics range from water error to mutation spectra, gene-environment interactions, and systems biology. So for the water project, this is led by Harry Himmen and Tim Swager. And this is based on the fact that we need to know the identity, the concentrations, and the locations, but especially the dynamics of contaminants to make good decisions. We also need rapid, cost-effective, portable sensor technologies in order to understand better how chemicals are moving through the environment. And ultimately, our goal is to guide environmental remediation decisions. And this is a picture of Irene Hugh with a really neat sensor that she developed. It's a deployable sensor. And the focus of this project is really on the flux between sediment and water. So what's happened is with decades of contamination due to chemical companies dumping chemicals into the environment, they get into the sediments and they sit there for decades and they continually transfer chemicals basically from the sediment to the water. And so we need to understand that transfer process and the kinetics of that process in order to predict how contaminants are going to be moving in the environment. Project two is focused on air. This is led by Noel Celine, Jesse Kroll, and Tim Swager. And sensors are again important, and Tim will be telling you about the carbon nanotube sensors that are being developed. That's on the bottom right corner. The goal is also to model the spatiotemporal dynamics of air contaminants and to predict the health effects of those contaminants. And one of the key things that's of interest is secondary breakdown products. So polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons can react due to chemistry in the atmosphere. And what can happen is they can change chemically into breakdown products, some of which are much more important biologically than the parent compound. And so if we're going to really understand the impact of contaminants, we have to understand the chemistry of what's happening in the atmosphere. Picture on the right is James Rowe from Jesse Kroll's lab, and he has an in vitro system where he can emulate the atmospheric chemistry so that he can look at what the breakdown products are and how prevalent they are, and then we can in turn study the biological consequences of those breakdown products. And again, this work is aimed at guiding environmental remediation decisions. Project three is led by John Essigman and Robert Croy. The purpose of this project is to define distinctive mutational patterns. On the bottom right, you can see the bar graph here, which shows different kinds of mutations, G to T, G to C, and so on. And what's really especially meaningful is the fact that mutation susceptibility is dependent on the flanking nucleotides. And so if you look at the pattern of mutation based not only on the underlying mutation but also the flanking nucleotides, you can get a high-resolution spectra that can be very informative. And it turns out that mutations stick around for a long time. So if someone has cancer, their normal tissue will still harbor the mutations from the original exposure. And so you can get a signature that you can use to basically deduce what the exposures were that might have driven that cancer. It's kind of like a fingerprint for what happened in the past. So this work basically is focused mostly on animal studies where we're exposing animals to NDMA and to PAHs, and we're looking at the patterns of mutation, and John Essigman's group is basically deconvoluting these patterns to be able to better deduce what the original exposure was. Project four is led by myself and Leona Sampson. We're really interested in NDMA-induced DNA damage, and in particular, we're focused on gene-environment interactions. The NIEHS has made it really clear that it's not enough to understand what's in the environment. We need to understand how genetic factors modulate susceptibility to those environmental exposures. So on the bottom right is a picture of a pancreas. You're looking at the whole pancreas of a mouse. And the nuclei are stained blue. And in yellow, we can actually visualize mutant cells that arise in the animal. And so it's a really neat assay. You take the tissue, you look at it under the microscope, and you can quantify the frequency of mutations as well as the extent to which mutant cells have clonally expanded, and that turns out to be also a very important factor when thinking about development of cancer. Josh and Jenny, Joshua Corgan and Dr. Jenny Kay, are the leaders on the project for research, and we're really excited about being able to bring together basic molecular changes that we can then use to hopefully predict risk of cancer. And since people are different in their ability to repair DNA damage, this analysis will help us to understand what governs inter-individual variation in cancer susceptibility. Finally, Project 5 is a systems-level response project led by Forrest White and Doug Laufenberger. They're looking at gene expression patterns as well as the phosphoproteome. So the phosphoproteome makes it possible to analyze dozens of different signal transduction cascades in concert. And this gives you a lot of information about the underlying mechanisms of cell responses to things in the environment. And eventually what we hope to do is to not only learn about what's going on biologically, but to also be able to develop biomarkers of exposure that might be used decades in advance of the actual appearance of cancer in order to predict cancer risk. So I love this figure because it brings everything together. Our project one is the water sediment interface, the extent to which things move from sediment to water. Project two is focused on air and the secondary breakdown products of chemicals in the atmosphere. As time goes on, these exposures lead to disease, including cancer. And of key interest to us are susceptibility factors being studied by Project 4. That's the genetic susceptibility due to changes in DNA repair capacity among people. And mutations, which will provide us with information about the mechanism by which these chemicals cause cancer, as well as the fingerprinting that I talked about, being able to deduce what exposures were present that caused the mutations that drive cancer. Project 5 is looking at the signaling networks and systems-level responses, both to understand mechanism of disease as well as to be able to predict susceptibility. Ultimately, all of this work is going to lead to, we hope, better biomarkers of exposure, better understanding of disease, which will then help us to predict, prevent, mitigate, and treat diseases caused by environmental exposures. For engagement and translation, we have a lot going on, but since we have a very little bit of time, I'm just going to highlight a couple of things. Dr. Kathy Vandiver and Dr. Jenny Kay are leading the way with our CEC and RTC activities. We have a citizen science project that I'll tell you about in a moment. We have quite a lot of engagement through education using tools such as the one shown of the replication fork. Dr. Vandiver has developed curricular activities where people have hands-on activities to do to learn to understand biological processes and actually even atmospheric chemistry. And that kind of tactile experience turns out to be a great way to get not only kids engaged in what's going on in environmental health, but also adults. We've done a letter writing campaign. We have a blog. I do hope you'll read our blog. Jenny is a fantastic author, and the blog is a lot of fun and very informative and a great way to tell your friends what you're up to if you're doing work related to DNA damage and disease. Our poster session was a great success on April 10th. We have our first newsletter that came out, and we're preparing for another one now. And again, I have quite a long list of things that we've been doing, interacting with the community, both through engagement and education. And I just want to touch on one activity. This was supported by the Center for Environmental Health Sciences with some support from the Superfund. And in this project, Abby Harvey and Telet Segev worked with Harry Heyman, Kathy Vandiver, John Essigman, and Robert Croy to do a citizen science project for the Passamaquoddy tribe. And what they did is they collected hundreds of tap water samples and analyzed them for the presence of arsenic. And they were able to identify areas with high arsenic levels and to communicate those findings in a meaningful way to the Passamaquoddy and other community members. And this project was focused on arsenic, but what we see it as is basically a way for us to develop our citizen science capacity so that we can follow up with similar kinds of studies looking at NDMA that may be present in people's drinking water. I do encourage you to go to see our blog, and also I wanted to mention that we have another engagement activity, which is the NextGen Protocols website. One of the challenges that we face with reproducibility of data is having really good protocols available. Sorry, the challenge is that we don't have sometimes the really good protocols available. So this is a website where people can put up their protocols. It's open to everybody. And what's neat is you can add in video clips to show some of the more intricate steps in a protocol. And that really helps to communicate better how to do some difficult-to-do experiments. So I hope people will take advantage of that website. So our vision is, of course, that all of the projects interact with all the other projects and with all of the other cores, and our, you know, in a perfect world, we would all be interacting in a giant network. You know, we're working towards this. We have a lot of collaborations that are being developed right now, but it's important to note that just by bringing this team together on a regular basis, we're really learning a lot from each other, and our work is very much affected by each other's perspectives and what they're learning. And I think this has just been such an exciting way for us to bring people together. And, you know, we've already made progress in our first year that we're excited about, and we're really looking forward to some interesting collaborative results. So I'm now going to turn it over to Tim Swager, and he'll tell you a little bit about the work on sensors that's relevant to projects 1 and 2.
Okay, thank you, Bevan. So I'm going to tell you about some work we do on designing chemical sensors. I work in the area of organic materials and analytical methods, and I'm often, you know, looking for new challenges, and the center has really presented some excellent opportunities for us. So I'm mainly going to tell you about the work that was initiated by Maggie Fiff, and she's been supported by Lennon and Jessica Lennon, and more specifically, Jessica's working on a little different type of sensor, but that's a story for another day. We are interested in trying to get beyond the conventional paradigm of how you go about doing these analyses of contaminants in the field. Often you have to take samples on site and take them back to a laboratory using sophisticated equipment, and it is very technical. Now, this is a good way for kind of truth sensors, where you really have established methods to come back on. And this is not something that's going to go away, but it can be augmented by coming up with low-cost portable sensors that could be either handheld or actually be autonomous for real-time continuous monitoring in the field. And this will give you not only the spatial readings, but also temporal readings, and which can be correlated between different sites. It's kind of hard to take samples at every site simultaneously normally. So we view that moving towards this other model of having these distributed sensor networks is very key, all along making sure that everything's working, coming back to a laboratory setting, which we have some very good facilities here at MIT to support that. Okay, so our technology that we are pushing forward very strongly on and have developed over the years is based on carbon nanotubes. These are electrically conducting systems, and I show kind of just a schematic representation of a device here where we have nanotubes between two electrodes. They can have things stuck around them that give, I'll show you some examples of that, to give them the ability to detect things. The advantage of this system is it can be very small. It can have very low power. It can be inductively powered, actually, by a smartphone. And it can also be very low cost, and it's naturally put into wireless networks as a result of its electrical nature. The technical needs, really, are that we have things that are highly sensitive. Fortunately, carbon nanotubes are highly sensitive intrinsically. One of the things I like to say about them, they're great sensors. They respond to everything. So the real key here is that carbon nanotubes need to be functionalized in a way that bring the signal that you're looking for way up over the noise levels that you get in these systems. And that's where our group has really excelled, and we call that selectivity, that we really design in a way to get very highly selective and large responses to something we're looking for. And then if you have really high selectivity and you have good stability in your device, other things that, you know, the stability is something we also work very heavily on, ideally you have a device that does not need constant calibration, which also is also very important for these fieldable sensors. And so putting all this together, we think that this is an excellent platform to create sensor arrays and networks that can solve these large data problems and ideally create interconnected networks where we have things connected to the cloud. We have strong big data analytics that go along with these large data sets. And the dream here is to look at basically life for everybody on this planet very holistically and use our smartphones more than just telling us what the traffic patterns are up ahead of us, but actually to tell us where pollution is coming from, where our exposure is coming from, help us have attribution when we are exposed. So Bevan went through the importance of NDMA earlier. This is just a recap on that, showing that you have a biological process that makes methyldiazonium, which then can cause mutations, showing a little different mutation that she showed. But you get point mutations, which give the toxicity, which now can generate cancer in the long run. Now, for us to develop sensors for MDMA, the first thing we started doing is looking through the literature and find out what was chemically known about this molecule and what types of things did it like to do. And one thing that became very clear is that the majority of the coordination chemistry, that's the inorganic chemistry around this molecule, was it binding to different porphyrins. These are synthetic versions of the porphyrins that are in biology, but porphyrins that have different metals in them. So these are some sampling from the literature. So what we first went to do is to go make some sensors using these. And again, we use carbon nanotubes between two electrodes. And the simplest embodiment of this is shown, where we just simply put a voltage across those electrodes and we measure the current that flows through them, the conductance. And that conductance will vary with chemical signals. Now, I mentioned also that these sensors can be very, very low power. In fact, as you can detect the signals using the RF or the near field capabilities of your smartphone. I won't go into that today, but that's something we're actively looking at, and we think actually could be a really good way to engage the public. Also, we have developed many different ways to fabricate sensors, including just even drawing them, like with a pencil made out of carbon nanotubes. Okay, so once you have your sensor fabricated, you get results, and when you expose it to different things, and this is just showing kind of representative profile, and that's just a change in the conductance or the current that's flowing between two electrodes, with the inflection there being when the gas molecule of interest is being exposed to our material. Now, how this happens in a laboratory is we actually make usually arrays of sensors, and we use kind of macroscopic gold electrodes. They can be miniaturized, but for us it's just easier to fabricate things at macroscopic levels, and we put them into a closure. We run gases over them, and in the case of NDMA, we, of course, put it through something to basically destroy it before we, to make sure that it doesn't run around up the hoods or other things in our laboratory. So we went and decided to look at a whole array of these different porphyrin metal compounds. And what Maggie Hook did here is she just took these and absorbed them to the sidewalls of carbon nanotubes, a very simple, quick screening. And what she found out is the cobalt was a very specific perchlorate counterion that does not tend to interact strongly with the metal. It gave us the largest response. So she said, okay, that's where I'm going to focus. That's where I get my biggest response. And now the issue is to make really stable sensors. And in order to do that, what we do is I look at this. This didn't come through quite as clear as it does on my computer, but the key is the one in yellow. Is we actually have the ability to chemi-selectively put different groups on these carbon nanotubes, and the pyridine group there is very important because it basically can interact with the porphyrin and essentially create a strong linkage. It prevents the porphyrin from moving around. It gives us that stability that doesn't require calibration. And what Maggie did is she went through a optimization of how many of those, how many of the groups that she wanted to put on the carbon nanotubes. And she came up with, from this graph, you can see that the blue curve on the right is the highest response when she has 1.4 pyridine groups per 100 carbons. And the little colored bands on the carbon nanotube down there, each color represents 100 carbon atoms. And that, so that's kind of can show you kind of schematically what the density of these groups looks like. At least the pyridyl groups and the porphyrins on them are not shown exactly in that, but are in our sensors. So we made sensors like this. They work really fairly well. We have some error bars here that maybe need a little bit more refinement. Still early days, and these sensors, and drawing a straight line through these probably isn't the best, but it does show you that it seems to have some sort of linear relationship. Hopefully, if we get the sensors optimized further, we'll get that better data around that. But that's what you would expect for a well-behaving sensor to MDMA, and this is just a change. The vertical axis is the change in the conductance through these groups. But what's more important is that it is relatively immune from kind of interferences that you wouldn't necessarily find all these out in the field, but they have what chemical similarities in our mind to MDMA. And the interferences are at twice the concentration of NDMA, which is the far right. So you can see that if we did those in kind of a one-to-one ratio, those interferences would even be lower yet. And so it looks like we have a reasonable sensor here that we can build on, and have shown that we can this functionalization is key to create sensors for MDMA, and that this we have a reasonable dose profile, at least so far. We think that we can do better than that, and the chemical specificity is also very high, which means that we should have a robust sensor that can operate in the field with be relatively immune from interferences and give us reliable data. So next steps that we're interested in, we're working towards taking our smartphone methods to make environmental sensors that can be used out in the field, and we want to do field testing with this MDMA sensor we have, collect data from and concentrations from different locations. We have some portable capabilities already, and we're refining those as we go ahead. And ideally, we'd like to get the spatial temporal dynamics of MDMA in the environment and using this method and, help people to know their environment and protect them from exposure. So with that, I think we're done here, yep. And we're time for questions.
Yes, thank you all for listening.
Great, thanks for a great presentation. Okay, we will start off with the questions. The first question that came through is, you mentioned the flanking bases play a big role for the site of damage. Is this independent of cell type?
So John Essigman is here, and that's his project, so he'll go ahead and answer that.
So far, it is. We test drove the system with aflatoxin, and we've seen a context dependence from mutagenesis. Specifically, a hotspot aflatoxin causes mutations largely in a CGC context, with a G in the middle changes to a T. So we've seen it in mice, but when we process data from other labs where they have taken and they've done mutational spectra, and we put their mutational spectra through our computational informatics methods, we also see this CGC to CTC hotspot jumping out. We think it's a pretty universal thing. We've got the animals dosed with NDMA. We've got tissues, but we haven't done sequencing yet, so I can't tell you whether we're going to see something as striking as that, as we saw with aflatoxin. But you know, we'll just know probably in a couple of months.
Yeah, I think it's a very promising project. I should have mentioned we're actually looking not only at the MGMT gene for its role as a repair protein, but we're also looking at the AUG, the alkyl adenine glycosylase, which is the first step of the basic fission repair pathway. And AUG repairs a number of different lesions, including key lesions made by NDMA, including 3-methyladenine and 7-methylguanine. And so together, by looking at knockout mice with MGMT and knockout mice for AUG, we are able to look at repair for over 80% of the kinds of damage that NDMA makes. So our mouse models really give us a nice comprehensive look at the effects of NDMA DNA damage.
Okay, great. I think we have time for one more question. How has your team been building trust in the community? A challenge for a government or project supported by the government is that there's very little local trust.
Yeah, that's especially an issue for the Mi'kmaq tribe. What I will say is that the most important thing is longstanding relationship. And our program really has its foundation in terms of interacting with the Mi'kmaq. That comes from the Center for Environmental Health Sciences. And as I've mentioned, John Usigman and Kathy Vanderveld, Noel Saline, and others have spent time visiting the Mi'kmaqs sharing our science and listening, mostly listening to their concerns. The other thing that's really significant is that John Usigman has actually hosted members of the Mi'kmaq tribe and their environment lab. They've come down to MIT. They've used MIT equipment. He has hosted them in his own home. And as he says, the amazing thing is sharing of food, and in particular moose meat, which is a nice celebratory dinner that they had together. So it really comes down to building relationships over time.
Yeah, when they came down and brought moose meat, it was quite ceremonial of them presenting to us. My wife asked, how do you cook it? And they didn't know, so they had to call their mothers.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, well, we still have a couple more questions, but if we have time at the end, we'll address those, or we will send them to you all and put you guys in touch. Thank you again, MIT, for a great presentation.
Thank you for listening.
Okay, so next I would like to introduce the team at the University of Rhode Island SRP Center. We will hear from Dr. Reiner Lohmann, a professor of oceanography at the University of Rhode Island and the director of the URI Superfund Center. We will also hear from the URI SRP Center co-leader, Dr. Philippe Grangine, professor and chair of environmental medicine at the University of Southern Denmark and adjunct professor of environmental health at Harvard. More information about each presenter is available on the CLUIN seminar homepage and URI team. I will now turn it over to you, and thank you for presenting today.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for hosting us. We're, of course, very excited, and I should probably start off by saying that the URI Superfund Research Center, STEEP, it's all about PFAS, and I'll follow up with that in a couple of minutes. We're a team of three institutions. It's led by URI, but we also work with Harvard School of Public Health, where Dr. Philippe Grangine is located, Harvard School of Engineering, where Elsie Sunderland directs Project One, and Silent Spring, where Laura Shader works both on the community engagement and on my Project Four. So as I said, our center is called STEEP, the Sources, Transport, Exposure, and Effects of PFASs. And for those that haven't heard about PFASs yet, they're a very interesting set of compounds. We know by now that it's an everyday exposure for everybody, which is why we find them in basically everybody's blood. There's background exposure through consumer products and dust. They are used for the production of Teflon, so we find them on our frying pans. We find them in outdoor weather gear. We find them in stain-proof carpets and textiles. Of course, some of them go through the food chain, so they get into our diet. But main exposure that has been the biggest concern for most people has been exposure through the drinking water, and that particularly through the use of aqueous film-forming foams, which have been used very successfully to extinguish fires at real fires and at training sites. What makes these compounds so unusual is that they repel water and oil, and that means they actually behave very differently in the human body. So So they don't really bind to lipids as much of the legacy pollutants like PCBs or dioxins would do, but they normally charge at ambient pH or at physiological pH, so they're ionized, and they're often binding to proteins and partition to cell membranes, so their distribution in the human body is also different. What we have now, or we do know about PFAS by now, is that there's a wide range of effects because everybody's basically exposed, some are at much higher levels. And Philippe will go over some of the details of the adverse effects, but his own landmark study showed effects on immune suppression. We know there are links to being overweight, to resistance to insulin, and then potentially to diabetes. EPA has taken action on two of the worst contaminants. That was PFOS, the sulfonate with 8 carbon, and the PFOA, an octanoic acid also with 8 fluorinated carbons. The result has been that industry has come up with other chemistry that fulfill the same technical needs, and often these are the similar compounds. Either they are shorter or longer perfluorinated, or some have more complex chemistry and are not fully fluorinated, and we call those polyfluorinated. So we're dealing with a wide range of chemicals out there that we might be concerned with. In the U.S., we are aware of exposure to PFAS across a wide range of sites, and this particular study was written by one of our deep trainees in her early work, Cindy Yu. She looked at EPA's UCMR3 data, so the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule 3, in which all major public water supplies were tested for PFAS, and by and large, they were found wherever you see colored dots on these small maps. And at those sites, you find concentrations that are in the tens to hundreds of nanograms per liter, and they are certainly above what EPA right now considers safe for human consumption over a long time. The other thing that became clear is you see different signatures of these compounds depending if you look at the groundwater or in surface waters. That, of course, reflects different pathways and sources leading to the presence of these contaminants in the water. So then the other thing that Cindy did, with help from some of us, was to come up with basically detecting the reasons why PFAS are elevated in certain waters and not in others. And so by now we know that roughly 6 million people were exposed to drinking water that was contaminated with PFAS above what the EPA considers safe for a lifetime health advisory. And so the recipe, if you want to call it such, to get a lot of PFAS is where if you have industry production site, that certainly gives you a lot of exposure. But also if there's a military training fire site, that will help. Or if there's an AFFF certified airport, so an airport that uses aqueous film forming foams. And then lastly, if you have a sufficient number of wastewater treatment plant effluents upstream, then again, you will end up with one of these water bodies where you have detection of PFAS. So most of the things we know, as of a few years ago, small public water supplies that serve less than 10,000 people were not tested regularly, so we don't really know how many other people are out there that are drinking water that is affected. Private wells were not tested at all. The other big question, there's a big debate right now in Washington and the different states, is whether the EPA advisory is sufficiently protective. Right now it stands at 70 nanograms per liter for PFOA and PFOS. And the state of New Jersey has issued its own guidelines that are lower and just issued an enforceable MCL for PFNA, so there's the debate is shifting, and we'll see where it ends. The other question, of course, is whether we target all the relevant PFASs right now and whether we have to go to totals. Well, that's something that we'll look into over the years to come. So with that in mind, STEAT was formed to look at the transport and fate of PFASs in the groundwater. That's Project 1. And then have a coupled by human and animal study to look at the uptake and the effect of PFAS in animals and in humans, and Philippe will talk about that in a minute or two. We look at novel detection tools for PFAS and then use all of these insights to engage communities to to, of course, reduce their exposure and raise awareness. That started off with drinking water testing, which we're doing right now on Cape Cod. And, of course, we're seeing whether we can give any guidance of which chemicals are safe. So the overall center, as I had said, Philippe Grandjean and myself, we lead the center. We have four required courses, community engagement, that is led by Alison McCann from URI and Laurel Shader from Silent Spring, and I'll show some of the work later on. The Research Translation Corps is led by the URI's Coastal Institute, Judith Swift and her team. The Training Corps is, again, at URI from Bong Sup Cho, John Stevenson, and I'll show some of their work in a few slides. And then we have a coordinator, Wendy Lucht, to help us with the admin at URI. We then have two biomedical projects here that tightly interact to detect the pathways and effects of PFAS in animals and humans, and then two engineering projects. And at this stage, I'll pass on to Philippe Grandjean.
Thank you, Reiner. I'm happy to be here and tell you a little bit about what we do when we go to the biomedical aspects of PFAS exposures. Now, when you're considering what to do to try to elucidate what's going on in regard to human health risks, you have to figure out which age are we talking about here in regard to the exposure. Is there some age that's more vulnerable than another age? And in regard to the outcomes, what ages do you want? I mean, do you just want to do cross-sectional study and do everything at one time? Or do you want to know the profile of the PFAS exposures and the different PFASs over time? And so what we decided to do was, of course, to do a prospective study. And what we did to facilitate this choice was to rely on a birth cohort we had already established in a community where we get a lot of good response, a high participation rate. So we centered on the Faroe Islands that are way out there in the North Atlantic, between Iceland and Norway, I guess. And you see a kid here in the Faroese national costume sitting on the shoulders, and it could have been a steep participant. but anyway, we're trying to figure out what it takes to make sure that these kids stay healthy despite the exposures that they have. So the cohort was a total of 490, as it says here, and because it took time before the grant was awarded to us, you know, we couldn't stop the growth of the kids, and we wanted originally to look at them at age 7, and we ended up at a bit later because of various delays at 8 to 9 years. But once we had the funding, we put full steam on getting all of the kids examined at the same time and about the same age. So we managed during the first project year just about to examine 407 of them. So we got 83% or something, which we think is pretty reasonable. In regard to this work, we have been reworking our serum PFAS analysis. We were originally capable of determining 19 different peaks on LC-MS, tandem-MS, and we're now extending that. But some of the more recent PFASs have not yet been detectable, at least not in our hands, but we're prepared. So the reason we are in this project, we are particularly focusing on the immune system, is that we conducted a study that was published in JAMA a few years ago of vaccine antibodies in these kids, simply because when children are being vaccinated, it's really a natural experiment. You inject them with an antigen, the same amount, the same age, and probably also at various intervals that are just about the same. And all we had to do was to get a serum sample and measure, so what did that produce in terms of specific antibodies? And this is the diphtheria results, and you see on the left-hand side the vertical scale, it's logarithmic, and you have the PFAS concentration, it's also logarithmic. And the exposure was measured 2 years before the antibody concentration, and you can see that there's a very strong association here. I should also say these kids probably have slightly higher exposures than U.S. kids, and you can see there's a wide range. So some are pretty low, and some are, substantially higher. So, and on the average today, according to NHANES blood analysis, the average concentration in adult Americans is probably in the no range here, like five or six, something that order of magnitude. But you can see you may well be on the dose-response relationship, even if you are all the way down in the low end. So the reason we are interested in these ages is that we know that these compounds also make it into human milk. And so what we did in a pilot study was to look at blood samples from the cord, ages 11 months, 18, and then 5 years all the way over here. And what we found was that some of them had pretty flat curves here. And this was a child that was just briefly breastfed for various reasons. But then there's some that went all the way up here, and this child here continued up, and then it leveled off a little bit. And this child was exclusively breastfed for 6 months, and then 12 additional months partially breastfed. And that means that a very important determinant of PFAS exposure in infants is the duration of exclusive breastfeeding. So we have decided that this is going to be a factor that we will take into account when analyzing the data from 8 to 9 years, in particular because this age range here, that is when the adaptive immune system develops. That is the immune system that responds to external antigens, like vaccines. And because it doesn't exist, that capability does not exist before birth. It's something that the child has to develop, and it happens here. And unfortunately, that is right when we see these peaks develops. This is a main issue that we will address. So when talking about the significance of this project, then first, what we want to do is to figure out what the benchmark dose for these kinds of effects are. And the reason for that is that, as you can learn from HESTR and also EPA and, for example, the European Food Safety Authority, that the calculation of what's called the benchmark dose, actually the benchmark dose level, is something that's used for defining the maximum risk level or the reference dose or whatever term that is. And there are statistical means of calculating that. And I can tell you that the European Food Safety Authority has used this method on human data. And although the report has been circulated widely, it hasn't been formally released because they're concerned that the very low benchmark dose levels that they have found for cholesterol and antigen antibody production and other effects, they're concerned that they're going to end up with exposure limits that are much, much lower than the limits or the guidelines that Heiner just referred to. So, but this is what we want to achieve. And we also want to, of course, address developmental vulnerability so that we focus on the most vulnerable population, and then that's what the prevention should aim for protecting. And then since the immune system is also associated with inflammation, we're going to use biomarkers that reflect inflammation, and because we have seen adverse effects on lipids and glucose metabolism, we'll also look at metabolic disturbances in these children. And finally, we hope that by the use of a variety of clinical markers, including DEXA scanning and fasting glucose levels, et cetera, we hope to be able to learn something about the pathogenesis of these outcomes, where, you know, adipocytokines and adiponectin and leptin, those are some of our markers that we'll use. And this relates to what we call Project 3, where we will be looking at new mechanisms. We will look at that in the in vitro, and we'll look at it in animal studies with mice. And the idea is that we will try to identify markers that we can use in the clinical studies of children, both in vitro and in vivo in the mice. And we'll also look at in various individual major PFASs plus some of the new ones and mixtures. So we will try to compose mixtures that are similar to the mixtures that children are exposed to. And those are efforts done by Andrew Slip and Jeff Botham, both of them at the University of Rhode Island. And I'll turn the floor back to Reiner.
All right, thank you, Philippe. So our next project, or our first project in a way, is Project 1, led by Alfie Sunderland at Harvard School of Public Health and School of Engineering. And Philippe was just talking about the mixtures, so she's looking at mixtures and identifying what they tell us about where the PFAS are from. Shown here are, and I have to apologize, Sarah, but I don't have control over moving the slides right now.
Okay, you want the next slide?
Yeah.
So she's identifying different sources of PFAS, and what you saw on the previous slide were using statistics to distinguish whether they're coming from an industrial application, whether they're coming from aqueous film-forming foams, or some consumer product. And the other part of Project 1 that's going on in a mobile fish lab on the Cape right now, led by Alan Vader from UC Denver, is to expose fish to real mixtures of contaminants on the side in those tanks, and then measure a range of outcomes and with similar biomarkers that we try to find in the mice and later on in humans. The other part of Project 1 is to understand the transport and fate of PFASs in the groundwater. And this is shown here is a slide that shows Andrea Weber's work looking at the presence of PFOS in groundwater below Cape Cod. And you can see two areas in red. And the one on the left is plume from a fire training area. And then further to the right, further downstream, you find another hotspot of PFOS, and that's actually linked to the infiltration of wastewater effluent. So even on that small Cape Cod, we see already different sources impacting the quality of the drinking water. Project 1 links to Project 4, which is my own, where we try to test and validate different passive sampling approaches for PFASs. The one on the right here are tubes that were used to detect dissolved PFASs in surface waters, marine waters, drinking waters. And here our main aim is to get an integrated response over several weeks or months, so to come up with what is the average concentration present in the water over that time period, which is, of course, highly relevant if you are worried about meeting certain regulatory standards. On the other hand, some of the sites we plan to work with, concentrations are really high. A postdoc of mine, Jitka Bessanova, is working with these really thin, spemy fibers that are less than a millimeter thick. And so they are really meant to work only at really concentrated sites, contaminated sites. And then these fibers take up PFASs. We can deduce the partitioning constants. We see they're fairly linear for the different classes of compounds we're interested in. And we hope to be able to use them to measure directly in contaminated soil or sediment what PFASs are available to dissolve into the dissolved phase and are available for biouptake. And the last part we do in Project 4, and that goes back to the background exposure, is to see whether we can find a simple measuring tool that looks a bit like a Halloween candy. It is polyethylene sheets, and they take up neutral compounds from the gas phase. And we have found in preliminary tests that indeed there's an uptake curve as we would expect. The longer we leave them out, the more we accumulate the compounds, and we can use them to test which compounds are present in the atmosphere to be inhaled. And hopefully we can use these to work with our communities to assess concerns about indoor exposure. As part of course our STEEP Center, we have our training corps, Lab Bong Suk Cho. We have a dozen trainees from URI and Harvard. They had a busy first year. We had a spring colloquium on PFASs where we had a couple of guest speakers and the STEEP senior people give talks about everything and anything we want to do. They have their own separate training meetings where they discuss anything from analytical protocols to field visits to whatever else they're interested in. We, of course, focus on the exchange between the institutions. The trainees just visited Harvard for a seminar and two of the labs. Of course, they've been on Cape Cod, and we'll envision them participating in the community engagement activities quite a bit more. And you see happy, smiley people here everywhere. Community Engagement Corps, as I said, is co-led by Alison McCann at URI and Laura Shade at the Silent Spring Institute, our local partner on the Cape. We're particularly concerned about testing private wells, which haven't been tested, but of course could lead to exposure to PFASs or other compounds of concern. So we have been actively reaching out to get volunteers to sign up. Over 150 have signed up, and well water testing is going on right now. And across Cape Cod, we have a wide range of potential PFAS sources, so we are also testing widely across the Cape. Of course, the Community Engagement Corps has done other activities, be that webinars or face-to-face meetings with us and the community, and of course, we'll continue to do that. The Research Translation Corps has been very busy working with the Admin Corps and CEC and involving the trainees to set up all kinds of products and tools. Most recently, our website was relaunched as URI upgraded the web system. So now we have, we consider, a very nice and elegant and hopefully very effective web page, www.uri.edu/steep. You see a picture of what's going on there right now. There's also a bunch of theory behind how the website is set up that includes the range of or the depth of which we want to draw in the audience to make them engaged and actually change behavior in the end. Of course, STEEP and RTC is not only about the website, but we also have all kinds of modern tools of communication that include the famous birds, the Facebook, the LinkedIn, Flickr, and so on. And of course, you'll see plenty of our student activities, research activities, as part of a website and the blog that we're building on. With that, I think we've taken enough of your time just talking. So thanks for your attention. We're happy to answer questions. Here's our emails and our web address. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much for that presentation. We will start off with the questions that have come through. Just a reminder, the question and answer pod is a great way to ask questions, or if we have time, we'll go to the phone. But I'll start off with the questions that have come through the pod. So the first one is, are PFAS typically found in petroleum fuels or additives?
No. PFAS are, I think they're big, and they're used as a solvent in production of Teflon. That has been a major industrial use and need for them because we use Teflon in all kinds of products. They have been very effectively used as components in the aqueous film forming foams, where we're now seeing whether we can convince even the Department of Defense to do away with requiring the fluorinated version. Luckily, there are no others. They've been used to treat food contact papers, but I'm not aware of any link as additives to petroleum.
Okay, thank you. Next question is, can you say more about the evidence that breastfeeding is an issue? In particular, are there enough controls for non-breastfed babies to be certain that the source is breast milk? One might worry about raising concern about breast milk in terms of public health since there are many benefits to breastfeeding.
Well, the standard response from the medical side is that breastfeeding should be encouraged. Actually, American women breastfeed for too short a period, according to CDC. So everything being equal, which of course it isn't, breast milk is the best nutrition for the infant, and therefore breastfeeding should be encouraged. On the other hand, if a woman has a high level of PFAS in her body, there may be a reason for her to consider whether to continue beyond 3 months, because it's in the first 3 or 4 months that the child gets most of the benefits that are associated with being breastfed. So, but that's something that I would advise should happen, in a consultation with a family physician, not with us. I mean, we're not advising individual mothers, other than we're saying breastfeeding is the best. Still, there is another factor here, and that is that studies in the U.S. and elsewhere have found that women who have high burdens of PFAS are actually not capable of breastfeeding for very long. So this is apparently an endocrine disrupting effect of these compounds on the female metabolism and hormone production. So we're currently looking into this in a separate project, but that may actually limit the tendency of a mother to transfer some of her body burden. She can actually transfer as much as half of her body burden to the child.
Thank you. Do PFAS break down into smaller constituents, or is the parent compound stable? Also, does the size of the PFAS have an impact on the bioavailability and or toxicity?
Yeah, yes and yes. To start with the first question, the perfluorinated compounds, so those where every hydrogen has been replaced by fluorine on the alkyl chain, they are very stable, and to the best of our ability, without fancy chemistry, they will not break down. Having said that, there are many what we call the precursors, so these are much more elaborate molecules that are only partially fluorinated, and those we do know break down into a range of breakdown products, some of which are then this very stable perfluorinated acids and sulfonates again. So it's a mix of both. The second question, yes, the length strongly affects the bioaccumulation. So the maximum bioaccumulation is roughly with 8 or 9 carbons in the chain. The shorter ones have much lower bioaccumulation. The longer ones, again, it drops off. So with 10 carbons or more, and that seems to be a steric hindrance. The different question is whether that's the only proxy for toxicity, and I'm not sure the jury is still out, I think, on if length is the only determinant of toxicity. I don't think so.
Okay. The next question, it has a couple different components, so just bear with me. What is the time frame for development of PFAS analytical methods in indoor air? What are the toxicological concerns for inhalation, different from ingestion of drinking water, and what is the status of development of reference dose in air?
Whoa.
is that you?
Yeah.
I mean, the vapor pressure is very low, so they occur in air, I would think, mainly as part of house dust. And they do occur sometimes in substantial concentrations in house dust coming from wear-off of, various textiles, wall-to-wall carpets, furniture, textiles, raincoats, sneakers that have been treated with these compounds. So they occur in house dust, but I wouldn't think that an air-based reference dose is anywhere near being defined, and I question whether that would be useful.
Thanks for addressing that part of the question. The question of the time frame for the air method, 6 months to 12 months would be my best guess. So we know the samplers work. Others have shown that other kinds of passive samplers work indoors, and there is indeed some link for the background exposure between higher indoor concentration in air or dust and concentrations of certain PFASs in the human blood of the residents in those houses. Was there a third part to the question?
Let's see, what is the status of development of reference dose in the air?
Yeah, Philippe already answered that. That might
not
be
sorry.
The most urgent concern.
I believe you answered them all from that one.
Good.
Okay. Next question is, what studies are planned for the effects of PFAS on metabolism and metabolic disorders?
Well, this is still under development, but I can tell you that there are two papers that were published this year that we were part of. One study was in adults who were overweight and who underwent 6 months of dieting with calorie restriction, and it turns out that that was a study called Pounds Lost. And it was completed many years ago, or several years ago. We got the blood samples from baseline and measured PFASs in serum in all the participants. And it turned out that those who had the highest third of the concentrations in serum, those were the people who particularly gained weight after the very closely controlled dietary intervention. So also basic metabolism was measured that indicated that those people were the ones with the lowest metabolism. That is, they couldn't burn off the calories. So there is probably some interference with energy metabolism, we're hoping that our study in children will also help elucidate this aspect. We did also participate in a study of the nurses cohort that was initiated by Walter Willard at Harvard School of Public Health. And it turned out that about 750 of the nurses who participated and who gave blood in the 1990s had developed type 2 diabetes. And so we measured their blood plus controls. And found that there was a clear tendency that the higher the PFAS concentration in serum was in the 1990s, the greater the chance or the greater the risk that woman would develop type 2 diabetes in the following years. So we're going to follow up on that also in regard to the glucose metabolism in the children that we are examining.
Great, thank you. We have several more questions, but in the interest of time and in everybody else's time, I would like to thank everyone. And we will be sure to pass these questions along to all the presenters so you can all be in contact. But before we conclude, and again, thank you, URI, for a great presentation. But before we conclude, I wanted to make sure everyone is aware of the related URL pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also, in the related URLs pod, you'll find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out this form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve this content and delivery mechanism. I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of these great webinars. For more information on the CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly newsletter, TechDirect, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also encourage you to visit the SRP website for more information about the program, and you can also follow SRP on Twitter. So I would like to encourage everyone to join us on October 1st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the final session of the series. In this session, we will hear from Boston University, Texas A&M University, and the University of California, Davis. If you are not able to attend the previous two sessions on August 23rd and September 4th, we encourage you to check out those archives. So with that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted a question and we did not have time to get to it, we will pass those questions along to presenters who can follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. All email addresses are on the seminar homepage in CLUIN. I would like to thank our presenters again from the SRP Centers at Columbia University, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the University of Rhode Island for their time preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. That concludes today's presentation, and thank you all for your participation.